Well, we are returning this morning to our exposition of the book of Esther, and we are also celebrating the Lord's table. And I trust that as we come to the close, you'll see there is a very natural connection between the theme of this passage and what we celebrate as we remember the death of our Lord for us. The last time we were in chapter 2, which we dealt with the first 18 verses that were all about how in God's providence and through some very unusual circumstances, the Lord took Esther to this highest position of being queen, wife to Xerxes, the emperor of Persia. And now we're picking it up after that event has taken place. And it's a little challenging when you're reading through a story and you know the conclusion, you know what happens, how these things are resolved. When you're doing it for the first time, there is maybe a heightened level of excitement, and you're wondering how this is all going to come together in the end, or how God is going to work. When you read it again and again, you may not have the same level of excitement, because there's not the same level of suspense. However, you are in a better position to understand the story. And from the perspective of the ending, to read everything along the way and how it contributes to what the Lord does eventually. And so we, yes, need to try to put ourselves in the position of a first-time reader and enter into the story with that kind of freshness. But at the same time, we want to look at it through the lens of the whole book and how the Lord, through these various events, is setting up for the amazing victory that he works out as a result. So here we are in chapter 2. We're picking it up at verse 19, where the character switches from Esther now to Haman for a few verses. And I think it's very important, as far as keeping it connected to the message of the book as a whole, to keep it connected to the structure. So I remind you this morning of the outline of the book that I laid out a few weeks ago. And to say that we have only covered what is basically the introduction to this story, where in the exposition section, the characters are being introduced and something of the setting, and nothing really has happened that is creating the kind of problem or conflict that's going to need to be resolved. That happens actually in part of the passage that we're looking at this morning. So when we come, particularly chapter 3, that's where the action starts to ramp up. That's where we find the complication that needs to be resolved in this plot. And so we're in this moment of transition from the introduction to the essence of the story. We're focusing particularly on that inciting moment in verses 1 to 6, but there are these transitions on either side. You do have Mordecai introduced a little more fully at the end of chapter 2. And on the other side of that complication, some of the first developments that are going to need to be addressed as this story moves along. There are some other interesting features as you put all this together. For example, if you look with me at chapter 2 and verse 18, it says that the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. And there's that idea of a feast that we have seen already in this story. It's one of these unifying concepts. And it's a feast of celebration. It is everybody in the city rejoicing that this new queen has been decided upon, and she formally takes up her role. And from the standpoint of a Jewish reader, that is an amazing development, that one of God's people ends up in this position, even though, as we saw last time, we have real questions about what she did to end up there. But we back off a little bit and we see the providence of God, and it's amazing. And you know, or you at least expect, that good things are going to come out of this. And so it ends on the note of that kind of feast. Well, look at the end of chapter 3. And at this point, it's a different sort of a feasting going on. It says at the very end, and the king and Haman, Esther's not in the picture here, but the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. And the reason they were thrown into confusion is because this decree had gone out that at a certain date, the people of God were going to be wiped out by Haman and others in the empire. So you go from a feast of celebration with such joy and hopefulness about it to a feast that is connected with this confusion and this fear of what's going to happen to the people of God. Really a total turnaround. And that corresponds to what is kind of a roller coaster all the way through this passage, where something comes up and you find it very encouraging. You think about, well, this could turn out really well. And then all of a sudden it comes crashing down and some other development is very disappointing and you're wondering how God's people are going to survive. It's really that way all the way through this passage. It's that way for Mordecai, because as we begin here in a moment, he's going to have a special role, a very positive place in the kingdom, and you're thinking that he is going to continue to grow in his influence and be such a representative of the Jewish people, but then by the end of it, because of his actions, in effect, the people of God are consigned to annihilation. And so there's that roller coaster as well with Mordecai. So that's the general nature of what we're going to see as we look at this text. And I'm entitling the message this morning, From Celebration to Confusion, reflecting those two feasts that I mentioned, From Celebration to Confusion, which if you're thinking ahead, you're maybe wondering, how are we going to end this message? Because the last thought is confusion. That's the word at the very end of the story. Seems like quite a downer note on which to end a passage and on which to end a message. We're all going to walk away confused. Well, hopefully not. It's at this point that we really do want to tie it in with the rest of the story. And yet, I do want to approach it in an inductive way, like we are reading this with freshness and just seeing how things unfold little by little without getting too ahead of ourselves. And if you think of yourself as a reader, particularly a first-time Jewish reader, the sorts of questions and the sorts of struggles that you would have had as you read each new incident that comes up. That's how we're going to approach it. We're going to note some details of each little section and introduce a question that section is designed to really bring you to wrestle with as you try to tie together the circumstances of God's people with what you know to be true about God and his covenant and his promises and his power. How is this all going to be resolved? Well, let's jump right into that last part of chapter 2 and the first scene of our passage, which is verses 19 to 23. So I'll read those verses for us. Now, when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the books, in the book of the Chronicles, in the presence of the king. And I want to point out that it ends with simply the recording of it, and you don't read in the next chapter anything about that situation anymore or what happens to Mordecai in connection with that. You go on to read about Haman, this new character that comes up. And so chapter 2, just like chapter 3, ends with things sort of hanging. Like something's not totally right here. We didn't read about anything exciting or positive happening with Mordecai as a result of his actions there. But let's take a look at it a little more closely. I want to note a few points here. First of all, in verse 19, it speaks of the timing, and it says that the virgins were gathered together a second time. And that's a difficult expression. What does that actually mean? There are different ideas about it. But it seems to be a development beyond what we saw in chapter 2, where there was this mass gathering of women for this beauty pageant to choose a queen for Xerxes. It seems to be at a later point. In fact, when you do the math, you see a reference to the seventh year of Xerxes in chapter 2. In chapter 3, there's a reference to the 12th year of Xerxes. So there's a five-year span in here somewhere. And however long it was, there was another gathering of even more women. Maybe they were women who did not have the opportunity the first time around to engage with the king at all because he chose Esther and they were kind of left behind and never had their night with the king. Maybe it was a totally different group altogether where they went out and gathered together even more young women for his pleasure. But either way, it is another reminder of the kind of environment in which the people of God were living as you read this story. That the people in control are driven by the basest of desires and for satisfaction of their physical pleasures in any way and at any level with no regard for God's idea of how that area of sexuality is supposed to operate within marriage. Totally unfaithful, totally immoral. And these are the kind of people that God's people are having to interact with and navigate exactly how do we live and how do we respond in these kinds of situations. And that's the timing of this event. And then we read that that Mordecai is sitting at the king's gate. Now, I don't know about you, but I remember when I was a child growing up and watching Sunday school teachers talk about this event, and they would put up flannel graphs of the story. And the sort of image you got was that Mordecai was just kind of hanging around outside the gate, almost loitering. Or maybe you thought he's like a beggar and he just sits there and has his hand out where all these people are going by to get a handout. That's really not the sense you would get if you thought about the cultural context here. Even among the people of God, in towns of the Israelites, early on, the gate of any city was viewed as though it were the place where the city was administered and where the elders sat in order to hear cases and to make judgments about legal matters and about commercial matters that were brought before them. And that is the sense here as well, only it's not a little Jewish village. You're talking here about the palace that represents the center of pagan power in that day. And so to say that he was in the king's gate is actually a way of saying he had access to the king's court and apparently some kind of official position in that place. He wasn't just hanging around, just kind of casually waiting for any word that might come from Esther. He actually had a place there officially and had an official role to play, which gives you a little bit more background to understand the tension that's going to come up very soon with another guy in the same court whose name is Haman. How did he get there? Well, it's not too hard to imagine that that would have been through the influence of Esther. That being in her position as the queen, she used that to leverage this relative of hers to be put in a position that would be to her advantage and to the advantage of her people. But either way, it's striking that now you have two people of the Jews in positions like that, and immediately you're thinking, well, it's a great opportunity for Esther to be the queen, and now it's a great opportunity for Mordecai to be in this role as well. And how is God going to use this? And this is awesome that here's somebody like Daniel who's in this position of the court now, and he can play this special role, maybe to give guidance to the king or interpret his dreams or something like that. That's the sort of spirit you have as you read this, particularly for the first time, anticipating that things are only going to get better. And yet, right away you're confronted with what it says in verse 20, that even at this point, even though she's already married to the king and would seemingly have nothing to worry about, she still, under Mordecai's instruction, is not giving information to people about where she came from, her origin, ethnically, nationally, that she was a Jew. And so there is this hesitancy. Unlike people like Daniel, there are a lot of contrasts that we're seeing between these folks and Daniel, of probably for self-protection. And because their situation was risky and uncertain, not just coming out and saying who they were and where they came from. So again, as a first-time reader, you're kind of wondering, how's that going to work here? Well, let's consider a few more thoughts about this passage. Because as you go on to the next little part, you sort of move away from the questions to another positive development. And what do you read in verses 21 to 22? But that Mordecai actually does something very positive to support and to protect the emperor. And somehow he hears about this conspiracy, and he passes it on by way of Esther. And through that, the king's life is spared from assassination. And Mordecai is actually recorded as responsible for rescuing the king, which would have been very realistic because, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, 14 years approximately after he married Esther, this man was assassinated by some of his own people. And so there's a lot of tension in the court and a lot of intrigue, as you might expect, in these kinds of pagan environments. And on this occasion, in the providence of God, Mordecai plays a role and is kind of a hero figure in that regard. And so as you're reading it, you're wondering what other heroic acts are going to come out of the life of these people, and what other doors of opportunity is God going to open for them in this very unusual situation as Mordecai and Esther are collaborating, and they end up successfully saving the king. That's only going to be in their favor and give them more opportunities. Well, that is what you would normally think, but things don't develop that way right away anyway. And what you do find are a couple of other factors here. As you're reading verse 23, just like we found the motif of the feast that comes up throughout this book, this business about the gallows is starting to come up as well, which seems like kind of a harsh image right in the middle of what is something very positive, but that was the end of the enemies. They were hung on gallows. Now, there again, there's probably a cultural disconnect between our experience with gallows and what went on back then. It probably was the case that these men were executed in some other way and then hung on these gallows, not to kill them, but to put them on display for some time as a visible graphic demonstration of this is the fate of the people who try to oppose this king. They're hanging on the gallows was more of a statement to other people as a warning and a deterrent than it was the method of execution. And so that comes up for the first time, and we want to be thinking about and looking for other references to the gallows. But what is really unusual at this point is that you don't have any statement about Mordecai being officially honored or rewarded for this great act to deliver the king. And that is unusual. That is unusual for Christians, for example, because we're used to the idea of gratitude and honoring those who serve us and so forth. But it was even unusual in this pagan environment. Because these people in high positions of authority, if for nothing else as politicians, they are always thinking about currying friendships and using relationships for their benefit and encouraging those who already support them in order to generate even more loyalty and building this network of people that are behind you. And part of how you do it is by promoting them to high positions, by giving them money, by formally recognizing them and forming up a sort of an unofficial team of protectors around you that way. This is how politicians operate. And these ancient emperors were very much that way. They recognize the value of incorporating others, whether for political support or for the wisdom and the role that they could contribute. So you can think all the way back to the book of Genesis and remember the story of Joseph and how upon interpreting that dream for Pharaoh, like on the spot, this guy that was just pulled out of jail, and the king had no experience with him to say that, you know, when he gives this interpretation, he knows what he's talking about, and I need to trust him. Just on the spot, he trusts him, and immediately he's made into the second most powerful person in the country of Egypt. That's just incredible, but that is how they tended to operate. And you can think as well about closer to this time frame, Daniel. And of course, he was already promoted into positions of authority in the court of the Babylonians, but there was a situation in chapter 5 when he interpreted something else, the writing on the wall, and again, on the spot, as he had promised, the emperor says, now Daniel's going to be placed in the third position of authority in this very high place of power and influence in a pagan court. That there was precedent for this kind of thing, and that was pretty normal for these people. Why was it not done for Mordecai? That's really a mystery. You don't really understand. It doesn't make sense even from a general political ancient empire standpoint that his name is written down, but nothing is ever done to express gratitude or to promote him or to create a stronger alliance with him. You're just kind of scratching your head. This really doesn't make any sense. And this is not how you would have expected things to unfold. A lot of this passage is very positive, and a Jewish reader would have had his hopes growing along the way, but then it just kind of ends on this question mark of, okay, what happened? And why wasn't he recognized? There's just a note of mystery, and basically you have to keep reading along to see how that's all going to transpire in the providence of God. But overall, the scene ends with this tension between expectation and reality. In other words, things don't turn out the way they, quote unquote, should have on paper. There are some very encouraging developments, but it does not reach the resolution that naturally you would have anticipated as you know about the background of Esther, her position, and this great act on the part of Mordecai. Things are just kind of left up in the air, and you're scratching your head. You don't really know what was that all about. And as you shift to something else in chapter 3, it's just like left behind, and you're just left in the fog about that particular section of the story. And it left the people of God reading this with this question. Is God still at work when his people's circumstances unfold in a way that does not make sense? That ends up disappointing you because it generated hopes and those hopes were unmet? What does that say about God? Does that mean that God forgot about them? Does that mean that God was just, he could get Mordecai so far, but he couldn't finish the job and get him on to the next level of a promotion or whatever? Things just kind of unravel at that part of the story. And God's people would have, particularly, not just reading the story, but if they had been going through these events, Mordecai himself, I'm sure this was a question that would have troubled him personally and Esther. the people going through this especially. You know, before there was a book of Esther, and nobody knew what happens at the end, and things are very murky the further they go on here. They're wrestling profoundly with this question. Do you ever ask that question? I mean, can you look back on your life? And you might be able to summarize your life in a few key events, a few of which seem very promising and very exciting. And then time goes on and things just don't pan out the way you expected. And you're looking back on that saying, what was that all about? What was the point of that? Why? I mean, the Lord, it's like he took me thus far, but then he just sort of let it go, and nothing seems to have ever come. It just doesn't make any, it doesn't add up. Well, you're not the first one to ask those kinds of questions. This would have been the experience of the people going through this for the first time. And we move on then to the second scene, which is the inciting moment for the whole story. And the essence of what happens here is that Mordecai, when commanded to bow before Haman, refuses to do that. And so let's read verses 1 to 6. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. And somebody pointed out that's kind of a funny way to word that, whether his words would stand in a situation where he was standing and he refused to bow down. Verse 4 continues, "For he had told them that he was a Jew." And so for the first time, that comes out. "And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus." Let's note a few features there in what we just read. First of all, following up on our wondering why Mordecai wasn't promoted, all of a sudden this random other guy gets promoted. You haven't read about him before. You don't know anything about him. He's introduced here for the first time. His name is Haman. And of all people, he's the one who is promoted, which heightens the tension that you already felt, wondering about Mordecai not being rewarded. Why did this guy get in a kind of position that actually Mordecai deserved? And folks, often that is true to life as well. That the people that seem like they're the most qualified for a promotion get overlooked for whatever reason, and those that seem unqualified are the one who end up in positions of power. That's just life in a fallen world, and this is another issue that this man had to wrestle with. And then the big problem that you're facing as a Jewish person is the identification of Haman as an Agagite or an Agagite. What in the world is that about? We don't normally pay a lot of attention to these family connections, but often they are significant. And again, as a reader of the Old Testament, a Jewish person who knows your history, this would have been very bothersome. Not just that some other guy got promoted, but that he was an Agagite? What is that all about? Well, the story goes back way early in the history of God's people. And I have the references there. We won't take the time to look at them. But back in Exodus chapter 17, the very first people group to have attacked the people of Israel as they left Egypt were the Amalekites. And it was an unprovoked attack. They just came out of nowhere and went after them. And it was the first time these people had to fight for their lives. And at the end of all of that, when the Lord gave them the victory, the Lord said, mark it down. I am opposed to the people of Amalek. And he goes on to say in Deuteronomy chapter 25, more about that. You put these two passages together as the theological background for what we're reading here. And God says, I intend to blot out their name forever off the face of the earth. And the time to do that was in the reign of the first king of Israel, and his name was Saul, whose father happened to be named Kish, and who was of the tribe of Benjamin. And if you remember from earlier in the story, the grandfather of Mordecai, his name was Kish, and he was from the tribe of Benjamin. And who was the king of the Amalekites where Saul had wiped out most of those people in partial obedience to the Lord? But he kept back a bunch of animals, and the king, his name was Agag. And whether you're talking there about a literal physical descendancy that goes all the way back to Agag himself, or as happened over time with the Jewish people, that this expression, the Agagite, came to be used in general for people that were enemies of God's people, the parallels between Mordecai's background and Saul's, and the fact that now Haman is described as connected with Agag, is widely understood to be reintroducing this major early conflict between God's people and their enemies. Sort of the paragon or the ultimate example of the tension between what we would say believers and the world, right? That's kind of what you're getting at here. That's how Jewish people would have read this. And it would have been deeply bothersome to you, troubling, frustrating, made you angry as a Jewish person to realize that this man in positions of prominence and ends up going after Mordecai is connected with that whole scenario that was never fully dealt with by Saul. And of course, God took Saul away from his position, partially because of that disobedience with Agag. I remember the first time I ever was taught this connection years ago by one of my professors. And he made this probing application. It's a little bit off point of the book, but still worth considering. He says, you know, when you struggle with some kind of a temptation or sin, and you sort of deal with it, but you're kind of half-hearted about it, and you leave a little bit of a window like Saul did, probably the time's going to come, like happened with Esther, that thing's going to come back later. And it's going to trip you up in ways that you did not anticipate. And so one of the lessons we learn about this is to deal thoroughly. Like Jesus said, if your right hand causes you to stumble, chop it off. Don't be half-hearted or go halfway about it. Deal with sources of temptation seriously, because if you tolerate them, the more time goes on, the stronger they're going to become, and that conflict is not going to go away. You've got to nip things in the bud and deal as thoroughly as possible with things. That was a footnote, but still worth thinking about. Now we're back to the story and this tension with Agag. Another few thoughts here. Mordecai refuses to obey not just Haman, but to obey the king. And the interesting thing is that the text and even Mordecai himself never gives the reason, though as part of his thinking, it says he was a Jew. Okay? You don't really know what his thinking was. We might say, well, to a Jewish person to bow down in front of this man would have been to render him this kind of godlike honor that was not appropriate. It was a form of idolatry, maybe. But would that mean that later on in all his interactions with Xerxes, that Mordecai never bowed before him as was customary, just like today? Even you would, you know, ladies would curtsy or men would bow when they're in the presence of royalty. This was a very normal thing. It didn't necessarily have those kind of religious connotations about it. Maybe this was a personal issue with Mordecai. He was just so ticked at the fact that he didn't get promoted and Haman did, that he said, I'm not going to bow before that guy. Or perhaps he was conscious of this Agag business and being rooted in that kind of history was just going to refuse to give honor to people that God had cursed the way he had. Either way, the text does not talk about that. And I think it's a way of the author saying, now, maybe it was a good thing that he didn't bow. Maybe it wasn't in this situation. But that's not really the point. In other words, the point of the story is not, man, what a great guy Mordecai was. He stood for his convictions. Let's be like him. He was awesome in his determinations and would not bow before this pagan ruler. That's not the point. The text avoids giving you that kind of emphasis deliberately. Because the point is, for whatever reason he had and however this all started, the issue is, what's going to happen to the people of God? And how is God going to work to get them out of this bind that they find themselves in? Don't make too much of Mordecai as a model of piety, particularly at this point in the story. Remember, as with Esther, there's just a lot of ambiguity about these characters, and it's really a way to not get you off track of the main point. Nevertheless, for whatever his thinking was, it does introduce the main conflict of the book. Now, you do have other stories where they lend themselves more to seeing people as positive examples when the text actually makes that point. And I was talking last time a little bit about Daniel, and we developed that further the Wednesday night after I talked about this second chapter of Esther. And also with Daniel, you have the situation in chapter 6 where his enemies in the empire, the Persian Empire at that point, were looking for a way to get him out of his position of influence, and they said, we're only going to find it with something that has to do with the law of his God. And look, he gets out there and he prays 3 times a day in the window, and everybody sees it, and so somehow we got to find a way to deal with him because of something explicitly religious that way. Okay, now that's a model. And it is presented there as something positive of his faithfulness. Here we're not so sure what in the world he's thinking. And yet, that does introduce the main issue that has to be resolved. And so you keep reading along to find out how it unfolds. And then notice the way that Mordecai responds to this. You can understand that he's angry. But his reaction is just over the top in verse 6 as he says, I'm not just going to wipe out Mordecai, I'm going to wipe out his whole nation. Does that seem a little harsh, a little vindictive, over the top? And does that remind you of any other kind of over the top response that we have already encountered in the book of Esther? What I'm saying is that Haman turns a personal issue into an imperial issue. If it was a matter of Mordecai disobeying, he could have just dealt with Mordecai, even on an official level. But in his rage, he turns against all of the people of God, and he wants to wipe out all the Jews everywhere in the empire. That development echoes the irrationality of the way that Xerxes responded to Vashti. Remember that? He turned a personal issue with his wife into this massive issue that now we got to make a statement about marriages all throughout the empire. And we saw how that the author was satirizing Xerxes for what he did in chapter 1. And actually, as a reader, if you're remembering that and you're kind of still chuckling about it, you're maybe wondering, well, this is such a preposterous response. It is so unexpected, so irrational. Maybe this is gonna pan out differently than Haman has in mind. It's just showing him out to be a fool to go to such drastic measures to deal with one personal enemy and now trying to wipe out an entire people group. But that threat is there. at the end of verse 6 and at the end of this scene, that is the direction that he's going to find a way to deal with all the Jewish people. And before you go to the next section, let's think about the question that the people of God would have been wrestling with at this point. Earlier I had asked, is God still at work when our circumstances don't make sense in a general way? Now here they really don't make sense. And it's not, I didn't get a promotion that I thought I deserved. It is now my whole life is at stake, and now I've threatened all my fellow Jews. Is God still at work when his people live under unreasonable and vindictive authorities? I think those are fair words to describe Haman and Xerxes. Unreasonable. These excessive responsive, these impulsive, irrational responses that are so selfish in the damage that they cause on all kinds of people. And taking out personal vengeance in such an extreme way, very often, these are the kinds of people that end up in positions of authority, in positions of political power. And does that kind of experience somehow undermine our belief in the sovereignty of God? When we read in the Bible that the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord and he turns it wherever he wants, and yet this kind of stuff, this kind of garbage happens, is God really governing my governors? Particularly when they're so extreme in their dictates and in their requirements? Or should I just throw away the whole thing and fight or find some other way than just waiting on the Lord? These are the kinds of questions that God's people would have been asking. And we move on to the next scene in verses 7 to 11. And what happens there is that Haman plans to destroy the Jews. He had the intent in verse 6, and now he finds a way. Let's read this passage. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, they cast lots before Haman day after day. And they cast it month after month to the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people. They do not keep the king's law, so that it is not the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you. Does any of that ring a bell? We think back on Xerxes earlier. And notice these factors. You would have known this as a Jewish person. But the fact that this decision about their destruction was made in the first month, the month of Nisan. In fact, a little bit later, it references the 13th day of the month of Nisan, which was on the eve of Passover. I don't think that's an accident or just a coincidence. That at the very time of the year that they're doing what? Celebrating God is our deliverer. Choosing and killing a lamb and eating it together as a way of remembering that mighty deliverance at the Exodus. At that very time, it was determined by these other pagan, powerful people, you're going to get wiped out. That cannot be an accident. And perhaps some of them were thinking about the timing, that even in the midst of this very confusing and troubling time, there is still a window of hope, if you just think back about the timing and everything else associated with it. And then there's the fact that the decision about when it's going to happen, the actual destruction, is made by the casting of lots. The wording here in our version, you might miss the point. It almost makes it sound like they were casting lots for 12 months straight. But actually what that means, and you may have a different version that makes it a little clearer, is that in that first month, they were casting lots, and as they were sort of testing different months, it finally fell conclusively on the 12th month, okay? This was a way that they practiced divination. And these people did a lot of weird things to try to figure out the future or determine the will of their gods. Casting lots was one of them. And actually, casting lots was a way that sometimes Yahweh himself, particularly through the Urim and the Thummim, revealed his will in ancient times. But here they were casting lots to figure out exactly when. And again, if a Jewish reader was thinking about this word, not the word poor, notice that in parentheses it says, poor is the Persian word. And it says they cast poor, that is lots. It's a different Hebrew word, the normal Hebrew word for that, which occurs in a hugely significant passage about the providence of God. Proverbs 16:33, the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. If they had connected the dots to what their Bible said about even lots, that would have given them hope as well, that the Lord was superintending this. And then there is the fact that Haman's got to get this approved by the emperor. And here we find that Xerxes is once again manipulated into a foolish decision with such far-reaching consequences. You read these stories, you get the impression, you know, this guy, Ahasuerus or Xerxes, kind of spends his time having parties and being immoral and drinking and as far as actually running the country, it's other people who were showing up and giving him ideas about what to do. He's just having a party all the time, and when something needs to happen or somebody has an agenda, they just find a way to manipulate and talk him into it. He's not really that interested in the governing part, particularly not at this stage when, as I pointed out before, he has been so thoroughly humiliated by the Greeks. And as Haman makes this appeal to him, he doesn't say what the name of the people were. He doesn't give a whole lot of details. He said, there are these people out there. And Xerxes doesn't ask, well, who are you talking about? I mean, it seemed like a basic question. What people? And the way that he presents it is designed to make them look a lot worse than they were. Yes, they had certain customs that were particular to the Jewish people based on the scriptures. But it was not true that in a general sense they were these radicals who were so different that they needed to be wiped out and that they constituted some kind of a threat to the empire because of their customs. And furthermore, it would seem that even the majority of those Jewish people were bowing down to people like Haman, and Mordecai had his own reasons for not doing it. It just was not rational, this plan that was being proposed here. And then he says, 10,000 talents I'm going to give you. That's a ton of money. It's been estimated that that was more than half of the annual tax revenue of the Persian Empire at this time. And Xerxes would have needed money because he was broke after that war with the Greeks. But where in the world is Haman going to come up with that kind of money? And it would seem to be that it's from the plunder that is taken from the Jews that he wipes out. The problem with that is, once the Jews are out, they're not going to be able to pay taxes anymore permanently going forward. So what sense does that make? All right, this whole thing is just a trumped-up, ridiculous kind of proposal, and yet he falls for it, hook, line, and sinker. No questions. Eh, whatever. Here's my ring. Let's put a stamp of approval. And then he says, do whatever seems good to you. Whatever looks good to you. Remember all that from the last time? That's the phrasing that was used to talk about this impulsive, selfish, just earthly orientation of how they went about making decisions. So just on a whim like that, this man is willing to wipe out who knows how many tens or hundreds of thousands of people all over the empire. So Haman succeeded. And when there's an opportunity to actually comment on Haman, the narrator did not have to say this. You would have picked this up from the context, but he wants to shout it loud and clear, and he actually characterizes him in verse 10 as the enemy of the Jews. And again, that turns away the focus from Mordecai and on the bigger question of who's going to stick up for the Jews? Mordecai surely himself can't do this. Somehow God's going to step in. Does God care? Can God do something about this? Is God able to turn around the purposes of the mightiest man on earth who on a whim wants to annihilate these people that God had covenanted with? And then to make another connection to the book of Daniel, do you remember a story about one of the visions that Daniel really wanted to understand, and an angel came in chapter 10 of his book to give him the interpretation? And he said, it took me a while to get here. This is the angel Michael, because I was fighting the prince of Persia. And what he's talking about there is that there are satanic forces that are associated with specific countries and governments. And there is spiritual warfare going on behind the scenes between angels in that realm associated with countries that have a direct bearing on the circumstances of the countries. And he actually, in that case, talks about the prince of Persia, referring to the angel that sort of had jurisdiction over this very country that we're talking about here. And it doesn't take a lot of theologizing to see that there was a satanic power behind this as well. Or to read history at all kinds of points and see that there have always been people that are so irrationally set against the Jews and want them wiped off the face of the earth. It's just not normal. There's no human explanation for the historic opposition to the Jewish people. And we're reading here about Haman, but we're really reading about the enemy of God himself, who, as one of his main objectives, has the destruction of God's people, Israel. And so those people, in reading a story like this, would have been asking this question. It's not just that my leaders are unreasonable and vengeful, but at this point, they're just dead set on oppression and injustice and annihilation and persecution for no good reason. This is entirely unfair. This is entirely extreme, way beyond the bounds of anything you could call justice. And there's nothing, humanly speaking, they can do about it. They're under the thumb of these pagan powers that are set on wiping them off the face of the earth. And they're asking this question, going through those circumstances. What happened, God? What happened? What about your promises? What about the great deliverances of the past? How are you going to get us through this problem? Do you even care? Have you totally walked away at this point? You're wrestling with that. Now, I would venture to say that of all these questions that we're seeing here, and that I'm saying, have you ever asked yourself that question, or this is very true to life? There are very few people in this room who have ever had the opportunity to wrestle with that. We think we're being persecuted when the government tells us to wear masks. That is not persecution, folks. Talk to Barnabas about this pastor I mentioned, who's a fervent evangelist and goes on Facebook and preaches the gospel, and he's arrested for blasphemy. And who knows how long he's going to be in jail. That's persecution. Those kind of people are the ones that can associate the most with this kind of story. But there are times when people actually do face this, and it might be us someday. And a book like Esther is designed to tell us it's not the end of the story, and America is not heaven, and the president is not the Messiah. There is a bigger kingdom here. Where is your faith? What is your focus? God is still at work when his people suffer injustice and persecution. And finally, as we come to the end of the passage, Haman promulgates his murderous plans, verses 12 to 15. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict according to all that Haman commanded was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel, and the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. What are we reading about here? Again, there are these connections, what we saw in chapter 1, that whole business about marriage and wives got to submit to their husbands. And it talked about the husband, it goes by his language, and now this decree has to go out in multiple languages to cover all these people, to get across this message to everybody. And it reminds you of that other decree in all those languages back then, which puts this in not so threatening of a light, because you know how ridiculous all that was and how God was working through that. Maybe he's working through this as well. And the text emphasizes, to come to the other side, and now the roller coaster the other way, just how thorough the destruction was supposed to be. I mean, this statement in verse 13, emphatic language, to destroy, kill, annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day. Incredible devastation that is being officially announced here. And yet, I don't know why this didn't cross Haman's mind, that in what he thought was the will of his God, it had to be on this 12th month. You realize it gave them almost a whole year for other stuff to happen that might turn all this around. It didn't say in the second month, like very soon. It bought them all of this time where prayer could be put into it, thought could be put into it, perhaps strategy developed, or God himself directly to work. There's all of this time that the Lord has to figure this out or to work out his plan. It's kind of weird that that was the will of the gods, that it had to be that month. You realize what's actually happening there. And then you come to the end, and it really does leave you hanging. There has been some encouraging, you know, little twists or subtleties that keep hope alive. But again, going through this first time, you don't know what's going to happen. And the last thing you read is, all this devastation has been decreed. The whole city is just in an uproar. They don't know, where'd this come from? And how can this be? This is so unfair. And the king says, hey, Haman, let's go have a drink. That's their attitude. Totally unconcerned, indifferent about all the suffering that they have planned, and just going on their merry way with their hedonistic lifestyle. That is where we are as well. Often, where those in authority are indifferent that way, and there are so many evil, negative, hurtful consequences as a result of decisions they make, and those in authority seem to be unconcerned. We'll leave you with this way of stating the theme. Don't lose hope, because God remains at work in and through the bleakest of circumstances. That closing line, it can hardly get any bleaker than that. They've planned for the annihilation of a whole nation, and they go celebrate by having a drink. And yet there has been enough in previous chapters and in this chapter to keep the hope alive. Maybe just like a little flicker of a candle alive. But there are these little touches there And a sensitive reader is just hanging on to that. Maybe all these little fingerprints of God through all this are going to culminate in some mighty deliverance. I mean, I wish he had stepped in and like Sennacherib, 185,000 soldiers, you know, all of a sudden they're wiped out. That's not apparently how God's going to choose to work. But there's enough little encouragements here for me to keep reading and oh God, show yourself strong. You've done this kind of stuff before. Your providence is mighty. Surely you can turn this around as well. Now, what does that have to do with the Lord's Supper? I want to remind you of what we covered as we were wrapping up the Gospel of Luke a few months back. And the conversation that Jesus had with those disciples on the road to Emmaus in Luke 24, and he's asking questions of them to draw out of them their understanding and lead them to the right conclusion. And so if you drop down to Luke 24 and verse 19, they answer his question about what they were discussing and what had been happening lately. Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified. Verse 21, but we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. And now we don't know what in the world to make of this. That the one that we had hoped was the one to redeem us has just been slaughtered himself. And the sort of rage of a Haman was hurled at Jesus on the cross by his enemies. And yet our hopes were pinned on him. We are so distraught. We are so confused. It doesn't seem like there's any reason for hope anymore. And yet, they go on to say that some of their people, some of their women, amazed us and said that he is risen from the dead. Maybe there is hope after all. And Jesus, through this conversation, leads them to a renewal of their hope. And not just about a threatened death, but an actual death on the cross. That God utterly, completely turned around through resurrection and demonstrated the level of his commitment and his sovereignty and how he works all things for the salvation of his people. Folks, this pattern that we're seeing in the book of Esther is going to reach its climactic expression in the death and resurrection of Christ. And we're here this morning to celebrate that reversal. Just like there's going to be a mighty reversal that's going to happen before too long in Esther, and this chapter's leading up to that, and it's encouraging you to keep hanging on and stay hopeful and keep reading and keep expecting God to do things totally beyond your past or your experience. He can work it. Keep trusting. Okay, God did that in Christ. We're celebrating that and all of the eternal benefits for the redemption of our souls for all eternity through that final reversal. And so I encourage you this morning to think about the cross in that light as the chief display of the sovereign rule of God over his enemies, and to turn their attacks to our good by taking the death designed for him to be the means for the satisfaction of his own wrath against our sins. Only God could come up with such a wild plan and pull it off, and as a result, deliver you for all eternity from your sin. That's what we're remembering as we observe the Lord's table.